Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everybody. Good evening. I really feel privileged to be here in as much as I am here in this kind of, you know, this strange transatlantic embodiment. But I do feel a little closer to Canando, having just visited a couple of weeks ago. And I'm still carrying the warmth of that experience. You know, I'm still carrying the warmth of the welcome that I received from everybody when I was there. You know, the sense that I'd come home for a little while. So reconnecting with the Sangha, reconnecting with the space as well. I think exactly two Wednesdays ago, I came and I came with a friend, my friend Emily, who'd never... Am I speaking loud enough? Can you hear me? Yeah, okay. My friend Emily, who'd never been to Canando before. And so I brought her. She had an interest in coming. You know, she wanted to. She's known me for a little while, and she was interested in this place where I practice. And so we came on Wednesday evening, and we came a little early. And you know, we did what we normally do when somebody comes to Canando for the first time. We took our shoes off outside the door, and we stepped into the little anteroom. And I showed her the picture of Suzuki Roshi, the founder, and we bowed. And then we stepped into the Zendo and we bowed. And in as much as outside in the car park, we'd sort of, you know, we'd had a big hug and we were chatting and catching up, the moment we stepped into the Zendo, I didn't have to say anything or offer any particular instruction to her, but something happened in that we just quietened down. You know, we were no longer chatting in the same way, and you know, there was a sense of, I don't know, sort of reverence, I suppose, for being inside this space of practice. And it's not like she didn't need a sign on the wall to let her know that. You know, there was something kind of unsaid. There's something in the air when you walk in. And I think that that sense of a sacred space, you know, is something that is, you know, is practiced and upheld by everybody every time we come into practice at the Zendo. The way that we carry ourselves in that space, the way that we come out of our habitual ways and just take a little extra care during that time, it begins to somehow infuse the space with something a little bit different from any other room. And now where I live here in France, I have my own little practice space. The house where I live in, we have a room downstairs in the basement that was kind of good for nothing. It's not insulated. It was just a gray box. I wouldn't say it's not quite damp. It doesn't feel damp, but when the wind blows, you kind of feel it coming through the cracks. You know, this wouldn't be a family room or a bedroom, or it didn't really seem like there was much we could do with this room. So I said, well, I'll make it into a sitting room. There's a meditation sitting room. Yeah. And so slowly I took steps. I cleaned it. I painted the walls. I don't know if you can see, I put up a sort of a straw ceiling. There's some tatami mats on the floor here. You can't really see them. There's tatami mats on the floor. And then I went to the shop and found this kind of two-tiered structure that seemed to work very well as an altar. And then I got my little Buddha statue and put it on top of the altar, and a candle and an incense bowl and some flowers. And so slowly, slowly, this kind of little forgotten room downstairs in the cellar becomes a meditation space. It becomes a zendo. And it's a process. You know, there's been no particular moment during which, you know, it suddenly was a zendo. It just kind of crept up slowly. And even when everything was in place, you know, and I've kind of consulted with people who have much better training than myself in terms of forms and, you know, where things should go. So even when I had everything in place, then, you know, what was needed was to come and actually be here and sit here. And so my husband and I just started coming down in the mornings and sitting here. And I'd light the candle every day and light the incense every day. And after a while, every time I open the door into this room, I have a different feeling from the other parts of the house. You know, when I walk through the door, it feels different and feels infused with something. And back in January, I opened the space. You know, I let my fellow local practitioners know that if they wanted to, they could come and join us in this space for sitting. And so a couple of people have started coming, and they come and sit here also. And so more and more, the use of this space for practice is becoming kind of more condensed. And when if people come to visit the house and they'd like to have a look around, and I say, well, maybe you'd like to have a look at the zendo. And when we open the door and they step inside after they've taken their shoes off, there's this kind of sense of like, you know, that same sense when I brought my friend in a couple of weeks ago to Canando, there's just a kind of a quietness. You know, there's a sense of, well, this room's a little bit different. And we can create spaces like that. You know, I call it a sacred space. You know, that's what it is for me. It's a sacred space, meaning that it's a space where I practice releasing my habitual self and my habitual ways. It's a space that kind of calls on me to practice a certain level of awareness of being within this space. And in being so silent, it invites silence in myself as well. And so it's very special. You know, I wouldn't just watch TV down here, or the cats are certainly not allowed in here. It's different. You know, it's slightly different from other spaces. But of course, there's nothing inherently sacred about it. It's a collection of objects, and it's the venue for a certain activity. You know, there's nothing there's nothing objectively sacred in here. If every item in here was lost in a fire tomorrow, you know, what would really be lost, and what couldn't be rebuilt, what couldn't be remade? So this little space for me very much supports my practice. And I would really encourage, I think having a room in your house that you can entirely devote to meditation is an enormous luxury. You know, it's something that we couldn't have dreamed of when we lived in California. We used every square inch of the house for, you know, other practical purposes or storage or whatever. But you know, even if not a whole room, then maybe just a corner or a little place that can receive practice daily. A lot of people have maybe just a little corner in their bedrooms where you can put down a zabuton and a zafu, and that's just there to receive your practice, you know, whenever you're ready, whatever time of day, if you have a regular time of day to sit. So for me, who's always found it difficult to discipline myself to sit regularly at home, I've always found it much easier to follow the schedule of a meditation center like Canindo. So for me to not have that and to be sitting at home is difficult. It's very difficult. I find it difficult to make that space in my life. So having a, you know, having a schedule, having a place, having a form, you know, even clothing that I can put on, it helps me, it supports me for my practice. And you know, for me, the learning the forms of Zen and practicing the forms of Zen has been something that has helped me with my practice. And for me, I think my approach has always been a little bit like it's like learning a dance. You know, it's like, you know, here's how you tango, here's how you salsa. You put your left foot here and your right foot there, and you know, this is how you do it. And then you put the music on and you just kind of have to go with it. You know, we're following a recipe. Like here's a dish, you know, here's a shepherd's pie. And you know, you might look at the shepherd's pie and think, how on earth? And then, well, this is how, you know. You know, you get some potatoes, you know, you'll need some milk, some butter. And then you follow the steps. Yeah. I'm very aware that when I chose to practice with this particular form, you know, with Soto Zen, and I started practicing in the year 2001. In a way, you know, it was a little bit random. You know, a friend of mine invited me to a session. I was interested in meditation. And I realized that there was something about the way that Zen manifested itself, the expression of it, that it was, for me at least, and for my temperament. And my life, it was a very appropriate form of expression. Like find, you know, finding my, if an artist, you know, wants to express themselves and they eventually find their medium. You know, I went to art school at the time when I first started sitting Zen. I was also a student and I was at art school. And one of the things that, in the UK at least, that you have to do before you can go to university as an art student is you have to spend 1 year doing what's called an art foundation course. And during that 1 year, you cycle through like every kind of medium of arts that you can think of. So you do a couple of weeks of painting, a couple of weeks of like traditional sculpture, a couple of weeks of woodwork, a couple of weeks of digital art, I don't know, you name it, et cetera, for the whole year. So that you can kind of have a sense of what your medium might be. You know, and then suddenly one day somebody does batik, and they realize that batik is the thing that they want to do for the rest of their lives. Like that's how they find their artistic and creative expression. And then sometimes for myself, I realize that, you know, in the midst of learning form and practicing with form, I have to be careful. Because in the midst of daily practice, in the midst of being involved in something that we can do every day and that we practice every day again and again in the same way, there are some pitfalls. There are some inherent dangers. If we become automatic about something, you know, if we learn something kind of in our body to the point where we sort of do it without really being there while we do it, we become a little robotic. You know, you're not quite there. Driving, you know, I drive my daughter to school every morning. And sometimes I arrive at school and I'm like, how did I get here? I have no idea. Like, if you ask me now, what route did I take? How much traffic was around? You know, no idea. Just autopilot, you know, autopilot. So we can sometimes, you know, there's a danger that we can start to go through the motions. That, you know, practice can become just a little lifeless. And then I think another pitfall, and something that I've also noticed in myself over the years, is that we can hold on a little too tight to these things as well, you know. In practicing these forms and wearing special clothes and in the bowing and the, you know, the lighting and all of that big dance, you know, it's easy to maybe get a little arrogant with that too. You know, I've seen that in myself. Piety can arise when we stick just a little bit too closely to the forms and we forget why it is that we're doing them in the first place. A kind of a show of reverence, you know, an empty kind of reverence. It's something that I really appreciate about Zen practice that has helped me in these moments, is that there's this kind of wonderful method of course correction in Zen. You know, when you read Zen teachings that date back centuries and centuries, they often come in the form of a conversation between a student and a master or a teacher. And often what the teacher's doing is kind of just course correcting the student. You know, if the student's becoming like a little too intellectual with their questions, the teacher will just push them away from that, push them in another direction. It's easy to get stuck. You know, we have that tendency, especially if we're involved in a repetitive action, a repetitive practice. It's very easy to get stuck, or even worse, to sort of fall into a fixing of ideas. You know, you've been doing the same thing for years and years. Like, why would it change? You know, surely I know this thing. This idea that I know what my Zendo is. It's this sacred space. And there's a special way of being when I'm inside there. And that comes with, you know, a certain set of furnishings, maybe a certain set of values and conditions. And all of these things are, you know, what I call the way. Like, this is Zen, right? And suddenly what starts to happen is that it sort of concretizes and becomes a thing. And because it's a thing, everything that falls outside of that thing suddenly might be invalid. So it's a big part of our practice to loosen up fixed ideas regularly. Even things that seem to be right, things that seem to be in place. Well, that makes sense. Why would I change that? And I think one of the ways that I found, or that I appreciate within the Zen canon of literature and teaching, is the way in which irreverence is also held up. So in the line of history, when we read about this monk and this teacher, and their practice was so strong, and they were abbot of this place for 70 years, and etc. Within that, there are also figures who are more rebellious, who kind of stepped away from that system. One of them is a poet called Ikkyu Sojun. Maybe some of you are familiar with his poems. His poems are quite well known. I'll give you an example of one of his poems that resonates with me. It's called A Meal of Fresh Octopus. A Meal of Fresh Octopus. And the poem goes, "Lots of arms, just like Canon, the goddess, sacrificed for me, garnished with citron. I revere it so. The taste of the sea, just divine. Sorry, Buddha, this is another precept I just cannot keep." I eat meat and I eat fish as well. And I resonate with this. This reminds me a little bit of one of my favorite stories of Suzuki Roshi when, I hope I'm not misquoting it, but I think he went for lunch with one of his students one day, and the student said, "Well, I'm a vegetarian." And Suzuki Roshi ordered a hamburger for himself. And the student said, "Oh, I'll have a cheese sandwich or a veggie burger or something." And then when the food came, Suzuki Roshi had the student switch with him, and he gave him the hamburger to eat. It's awesome to be vegetarian. And there's a way in which even these wonderful practices we can cling a little too tightly to, and what's in that. That clinging can make us subject to all sorts of like tensions and anxieties and even guilt. I think guilt is a condition that's often quite closely related to spiritual practice. People often think of, I came from a Catholic background, or for some reason people seem to link Catholicism quite closely with guilt. But I think that the tendency is there, and it's present, its potential. Even in this practice, I didn't go to the Zendo this week. Like, I didn't do that. I fell short. I feel bad about that, or I feel guilty for not following this particular precept. I don't feel like a good Buddhist. There's the logical follow-on from that is that there are these sort of certain fixed qualities that we should be for some reason. That there's a precise set of rules and precise set of ways of behaving. That there are certain fixed qualities like calmness, equanimity, rule abiding, that we have to embody. Otherwise, otherwise what? Otherwise, we're not being good Zen Buddhists. And I think what happens, or the danger there, or what's happened for me at least over time, is that you could start to compartmentalize your life. You know, you can have like, you can start to have multiple sort of identities. You know, this is the Zen practitioner me. You know, this is the person that I am when I step through the threshold into the Zendo. But then I'm a very different person when I'm at work the next day or when I'm with my family. And there are all these things in my life that are at odds somehow, that feel at odds. You know, how do I reconcile my Zen practice with my passion for cage fighting? You know, how does that come in? I like to go to the pub and have a drink and a smoke. You know, I like to eat octopus. I'm politically conservative. How does that fit in? I have this thing for expensive watches. My house is a mess. I lose my temper. I shout at my kids. Just recently, I heard a Dharma talk from a local Bay Area Dharma teacher who was telling the story of how for a while when they were younger, they stopped meditating because they just felt that I think they were living in a house with friends at the time. They were, you know, cohabiting with other people, and they just felt that somehow their meditation practice, they couldn't reconcile it with the social life that they were living in. It just said that it felt like two different worlds, and it felt very weird. And so they stopped meditating for a while. Like, it took them some time to bring those two worlds together. When I think back to the first time I experienced Zen, I think of the first Seishin I went on. And in addition to experiencing and appreciating the form of Zen, I think another really important aspect for me that I think is so important that in some ways I honestly don't think I'd be sitting here now if it wasn't for the teacher themselves. The teacher was an American teacher, a man called Philippe Coupe, who I really haven't encountered very much since then. I don't really know very much about him or his teachings, but all I can say is that there was something about him, something that he exuded during that Seishin, that felt very mischievous and irreverent to me. There was this kind of sense about him. I knew that he was a writer, and that he had written both commentaries on Zen texts and, you know, sort of translated works of his own teacher into English, because I think they were originally in French. But that he'd also written some sort of autobiographical books about Zen that were sort of that raised a few eyebrows among the other teachers, and that they weren't, you know, you weren't necessarily, you were advised to not be reading them when you went to the temple in France, for example. You know, there was something about these books that was a little bit irreverent, that there was some mischief in the way that he approached all of this. And I think, you know, he talked about his girlfriends and sex and, you know, all sorts of things that just kind of wasn't, you know, maybe completely appropriate to Dharma teaching. But I found this so incredibly refreshing. You know, there was, for the first time, I felt that I was having an experience with something spiritual or religious that wasn't pious, you know, that was kind of just fresh and real. And I really appreciated this. There's all sorts of stories and koans in our tradition that capture this spirit. There's Master Linji's very famous line about if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. You know, the first time I heard that, I was, oh. My goodness, that really blew me out of the water. You know, that really sounded so sacrilegious. Or the story of Master Yunmen, when he was asked by a monk, what is the Buddha? And he replied, a dried shit stick. You know, again, oh, but you know, a shit stick was the old Chinese was equivalent of toilet paper, you know, something that you would use to clean yourself. All of this in the spirit of existing within that space of the sacred and the profane, of not getting too caught up in either. These kinds of things to me have a similar effect of, like, you know, listening to, I don't know, listening to stand-up comedy, for example, or like jazz music, or like looking at impressionistic art. You know, it's just sort of anywhere where I think that where you have, like, you know, the form, what's the official form on one side, and then there's ways in which people play with that. There's ways with which people break those rules. But you sort of need to know what the rules are in the first place to break them. I get a tremendous relief from watching stand-up comedy, especially these days. You know, there's lots of things that can be said in stand-up comedy that just, you know, don't fly in so many other arenas, at public arenas at least. It brings a sense of relief to hear someone say something taboo from time to time. That's not, you know, that's not necessarily harmful to somebody, but just, you know, just kind of loosening things up, breaking the rules. So for this reason, that the poet that I just mentioned, EQ, the author of the octopus poem, he's a very attractive figure to me. He lived in the 15th century in Japan. He began his Buddhist training as a very young child. His mother brought him to a monastery when he was very, very young. And he was sort of a bit of a genius kid. He published his first collection of poetry at the age of 13. And then as he grew older in his sort of young adulthood and into his mid-adulthood, he became very disillusioned with the institutions that he was practicing in. And so he left and he became a wandering monk. And he liked to go to bars, and he hung out in brothels, and he, you know, his friends were artists and musicians and courtesans, prostitutes. And he continued to teach the Dharma in these places. He believed that enlightenment could be found in all aspects of life, you know, not just in the monastery. Practice wasn't just in the monastery. You know, he felt very strongly about that. When I was looking up his biography, I came across this line that really struck me. They said that EQ had a deep commitment to expressing the essence of Zen beyond the formal structures of the monastery. Yeah. And just that phrase, a deep commitment to expressing the essence of Zen. A deep commitment to expressing the essence, you know. I just thought, isn't that lovely? And isn't that what we're all doing to some extent? Just expressing the essence in whatever way it comes to us. In our lives, in our doubts, in our shortcomings, as well as in the merit of practice. Expressing it beyond the formal structures We have the formal structures to support us. But there's a great deal of our lives that happen beyond those formal structures. Here's another one of his poems. "I Hate Incense" is the title of the poem. "A master's handiwork cannot be measured, but priests still wag their tongues, explaining the way and babbling about Zen. This old monk has never cared for false piety, and my nose wrinkles at the dark smell of incense before the Buddha." Now, they made this guy an abbot later on in his life. You know, he wasn't like excommunicated and no one ever wanted to hear from him again. This is part of it. You know, this is part of it. It's okay to grumble about all those wagging tongues and the horrible smell of incense. He became an abbot. He was invited back into a monastery later on in his life. And at the age of 77, he fell in love with a woman, a blind woman who was a singer. And he wrote all sorts of poems to her. You can go and read these. They're on the internet. And some of them are very graphic and erotic. And I'll read you one that's not so graphic and erotic, but I think it's wonderful. It's called "The Dharma Master of Love." "My life has been devoted to love play. I've no regrets about being tangled in red thread from head to foot, nor am I ashamed to have spent my days as a crazy cloud. But I sure don't like this long, long, bitter autumn of no good sex. Follow the rule of celibacy blindly, and you are no more than an ass. Break it, and you are only human. The spirit of Zen is manifest in ways countless as the sands of the Ganges. Every newborn is a fruit of the conjugal bond. For how many eons have secret blossoms been budding and fading?" So in that line, when he mentions, "I've no regrets about being tangled in red thread," I don't know how many of you are familiar with that, but red thread Zen is a thing. Red thread Zen. I don't know if you've heard about it. And if you're interested, there's a wonderful book by an Australian teacher called Susan Murphy on the subject. The book is called Red Thread Zen. And there's so much that, you know, I couldn't do it justice of going into it in great detail right now. But to summarize, it's sort of, it's a philosophy that EQ himself, you know, embodied and embraced. And it emphasizes the integration of passion and enlightenment, you know, passion and enlightenment. And in some ways it's an antidote to, you know, this kind of this danger, this possibility of stagnation, dead practice. I think when we practice with passion, I think practice energy, you know, the ways in which we cultivate our practice energy. When we have energy, the way that we practice the forms then becomes like a dance, you know. We're expressing the essence both within the formal structures and outside. And then everything we do, from stepping inside the zendo, lighting the incense, bowing, it's done with a certain zeal. like a dancer would, like an artist would. They're not just going through the steps, they're putting their whole selves into it, all of themselves. When Ikkyu mentions, sex and birth and, the red thread of human living, and blood and guts and gore, all these uncomfortable, messy things that are part of our life, all of these things are what we bring in, what we can bring in, what we can work with in our practice. We don't need to compartmentalize or just bring certain aspects of ourselves in. This is an inclusive attitude. This is an open attitude. It's engaged. It's engaged with our lives as they are. There's nothing that I need to suppress or leave in the shadows. It's about what's here in front of me. What can I practice with right now? This is the expression of this life and of the Dharma in this moment. And I think the more we practice like this, the more we expand the field of our being. And expansiveness is the origin. To finish, all of this and this imagery brought me back to a beloved quote from Suzuki Roshi, encouraging people to be mischievous. Give your sheep or cow a large, spacious meadow. So it is with people. First, let them do what they want and then watch them. Yeah. Don't ignore, but just watch, watch. We don't try and control, but put our sheep to graze in a large, wide, spacious field. Thank you. Thank you for your attention. And I think we have a little bit of time if you have any questions or comments or objections. Or expressions of outrage. Yes.
Can you hear me from here? Or do I have to move?
I think it would be better if you could approach the computer, if that's okay. The acoustics are a little shaky.
Okay, this is more of a comment than anything. There is a some Ooh. Authors. There's some authors by the name of Marshall and Shipman, and I think it was 1999, 2000-ish, if I remember right. And they wrote a concept called The Harms of Premature Formalization. And the whole idea was that, and they're in the tools for thought in the writing space. And they said, we ruin our ability to be creative and to write and to communicate our knowledge and ideas and to evolve ideas because we formalize them too quickly.
Mm.
The summary of their presentation was we need to live through our knowledge by constantly practicing incremental formalization. Meaning that you're constantly incrementing and re-incrementing and re-incrementing, re-evolving whatever you're doing, whatever your thoughts.
Mm.
If you consistently do that, you can evolve. So I thought that. So if you look up the paper, it's Marshall and Shipman, and it's a fascinating work. So that came to mind while you were talking.
Thank you. Have you practiced this as a writer?
Yeah, every day. Yeah, I've actually built a whole system around it. I call the 5 C's of knowledge management to unleash your creative potential. And I've spent the last 4 years developing a writing system around that concept.
Gosh, wonderful. Thank you. You'll have to share that with us sometime. That sounds fascinating. Thank you. Philip.
Thank you for your talk. And it's very refreshing. I'm also attending the Everyday Zen practice period. And I haven't heard a talk like this either at Canando or at Everyday Zen. It's making me think of back in the mid-60s when I started practicing, and Suzuki came to San Francisco. There was a well, people called it a sexual revolution. It was really people outside the people who were actually doing the revolution. But there was a real sense, a spirit of that feels very, very close to how you describe EQ and this. I don't know what Red Thread Zen is, but the culture itself was evolved to print a book like James Joyce's Ulysses. It was an incredibly repressed cultural environment in many ways. And Suzuki developed his practice at Zen Center during that time. And I think a lot of the innovative aspects of Zen Center and Tassajara practice, just like the coeducational aspect of it, had as much to do with the cultural ferment and revolutionary.
Let's hang on a few moments and see if, oh, there you are. We just lost you for a few moments there, Philip. And your mic's off right now.
It seems so related. And also it was a time when there was a struggle, of course, at Zen Center itself, but not simply Zen Center, but all at Zen practice centers all across certainly the U.S. that of kind of struggling with this issue, the issues of conventional morality or conventional monastic conduct, and this age of experimentation, and I love your bringing this in at it in the spirit of honoring the kind of practice that is not afraid to be experimental, and relating that to the possibility of maintaining a certain liveliness, a certain creativity. But anyway, it reminds me of those times, and I really enjoyed your lecture. Thank you.
Thank you, Philip. Thank you. You've tapped into such a sort of hot area of interest for me. I came on the scene later than that, and I have such a sort of curiosity and interest about the cultural conditions in the 60s and how it felt to be a Zen practitioner, especially in San Francisco during that time. I think I have almost a kind of a romanticized idea of that cultural iconoclasm, you know, of the beat poets, you know, of all these things that were going on at the time. I feel very drawn to it. I feel very sad that I missed it. I have great FOMO around this subject. I think there is something so radical in the method of Zen that I can understand why it was so appealing at that cultural moment. And at the same time, it invites such a careful response, such a careful interaction with this sense of freedom. Because what it isn't is it's not sort of wild, unbridled, immoral, unethical permissiveness either, you know, at the same time. There's something so deeply ethical in sincere practice, you know, the wisdom that arises from practice has its own very skillful relationship with the world. But I love what you named about, you know, not being afraid to experiment. Thank you. Thank you, Philip.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, May.
Thank you for your talk. Thank you so much. I hear your deep commitment to that practice that I can't remember, but I, in my word, it's a moment of innocence.
May, do come a little closer to the computer. There's still
I can see. Okay.
That's better. Thank you.
Sure. Somehow I think that the word of deep commitment to meet that moment or something, really, thank you. I mean, thank you for that moment. I just have a comment because I feel like we're constantly back and forth between something ready to form and also something not mature, you know, and then we keep back and forth. Once things become mature, it's not. Just like, and that's the form and that's the rules, that's the whatever. And now it sounds like we always go back to zero, always go back to zero, never mature. And that's the beauty of it. But yet we still can't help getting mature. And I think we can't stop it. We just can't stop being mature. But that innocence within the maturity, you know, is something that I feel like you're dancing. I think we're all dancing. Okay, just let's dance. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's so good to see you.
Thank you. You too. Let's dance indeed. I feel like we need to finish this with David Bowie. Thank you, May. Uma.
Hey, Vanessa. Can you hear me?
I can for now, yes.
Okay. I'll pull you a little bit closer to me.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, okay. So, when I came to San Francisco, I went to San Francisco State, and it was not a narrative film program. It was considered to be an experimental narrative program. So, we were playing with all kinds of things all the time. And one of the things that I caught was, I think, may have caught the spirit of San Francisco. But there were still people around who were quite rebellious back then. And one of the big things that I remember was going to the Red Vic Theater on the cat on 8th Ashbury, on Ashbury's, on the 8th. And it was a co-op that was being run by people who worked there. We used to get the movies there. It was their theater. They took the money from you. They ran the theater. And they would show films that were classics that had already gone through, like the first run. Like I saw Krzysztof Kieślowski's The Three Colors over there. Red, blue, and
white.
Yeah. So, but it was just that kind of spirit. It was that sort of fighting spirit that we are going to get through this together, and we're going to do this together. And, you know, running around scrounging film equipment. There was a place called the Film Arts Foundation, which is long gone now. But it was like going and getting cameras for them, because everything that they rented out was given to them, and it was a donation, and we would fix things together, and we would put things together and make them. There was this sort of independent sort of spirit of being able to experiment and, you know, do things, but, you know, some of the teachers that I had had been a part of the 60s when there was a revolution. You know, they were fighting sort of in San Francisco for academic freedom, and which wasn't given to them very easily, but they fought for it and they got their way. And so it was just like, so they could teach what they wanted to teach, and they weren't bound by the system. And it was really interesting to catch that spirit, but what came out of it was, I think, this feeling of independence that we can go and create something on our own. And, you know, and when I came to this place here, it was also, it wasn't like a part of San Francisco Zen. I mean, I always felt like this was like slightly different from that sort of San Francisco Zen Center or Green Gulch or Casa Hara, but it had that sort of independent sort of spirit that we are going to do things on our own. We are going to build something on our own, and we are going to create something on our own. We don't need all that stuff that is, you know, sort of, I don't know how to even put it, systematic. We can do things, you know. And so it was just, I always felt that way. And when I've seen pictures of the ponds and these little risers that Les and the guest speakers sit on there, they don't look like they were like, gotten from a professional place. It's like somebody put them together. I can still see the screws and the nails that have been hammered into them. And it still gives me that feeling sometimes when I come and look at it and say, this is the spirit of the 60s. This is the spirit that is still there, that still hangs out with us, that we can do this on our own. We can take something and build it from the ground up. And that was the whole, I think, spirit of the 60s too, that it was, we can take care of ourselves, we can feed people, we can, you know, give them, we can provide them with a place to live and you know, let them sit, you know, in that, you know, hippies were having trips and there was always somebody to help them with the trip, but over here, it's more like, oh, we're also going on a trip here, but we're going inside. So it's a different kind of trip, but we're here for each other. I've always felt that we've had that at this place too, that 60s spirit, that we were always doing something that was slightly, a little bit on the cutting edge out there. I just wanted to express that. But now that I went to Haight recently, like what was it, a week ago, you know, I went to have some pizza at Escape from New York Pizza and saw all those pictures that they have of everyone. Joey Ramone has a signed picture, and other people have a signed picture, and all those people are gone. But that is what has remained as a mainstay of 8th Street. And Amoeba Records, too, I think. Amoeba Records is still there. And so, but I just wanted to share that a little bit. So, you know, Rhetoric Theater is gone, but it was such a, you know, I think it was such a rebellious way of saying, oh, we're going to stick it to the man by not, you know, letting the corporations take this theater over. We're going to run this, you know, for the community. It'll be run by the community. It'll be run for the community, and it'll be in the community. So it was that sacred place that you could go and sit down and watch a movie, and you know these people were really caring for everything because it was passing through these responsible hands, you know. I just wanted to share that with you.
Lovely. I'm glad you did. Thank you so much. There's so much that I appreciate it, and it's so inspiring and invokes, you know, so much of, you know, what Philip was talking about. And also, you know, what May was saying about, like, there's that energy that can arise. And for me, I very much feel it along the lines of, you know, teachings around beginner's mind as well. You know, right, that energy that we have as beginners, but also when we just get on board with something that we love, you know. And so I think about the paramita of virya, of energy, of practice energy. You know, how do we cultivate that? You know, to May's point, when we mature, how do we still maintain that? We can go to Haight and Ashbury and see those black and white photos, and they're just hanging on the walls, and it's kind of it's become a nostalgia, it's become a memory. You know, this was us in our youth, and here we are now, and we're mature and we're different, and you know, we've grown out of that in a way. But how can we still skillfully cultivate that same energy, at least? You know, and when we're practicing with ourselves and deeply in ourselves and feel those energies arise. And I love your phrase, Uma, stick it to the man. And it made me think, just in terms of what I'm working with here, who is the man in this case? You know, like, what am I working with? And what is it that's preventing me or holding me back? I'll leave it there because I can see that we're 5 minutes over, and I really want you guys to have some tea and cookies together in the Dharma room or in the lovely garden. Thank you so much. What a pleasure to come together. I wish you all well.
We're gonna do that.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's kanndo.org.